And we all, Sirius included, want you to learn to protect yourself. So work hard, all right?
Yeah, all right, said Harry heavily, looking up into Lupin's prematurely lined face.
See you then.
The six of them struggled up the slippery drive toward the castle, dragging their trunks. Hermione was already talking about knitting a few elf hats before bedtime. Harry glanced back when they reached the oak front doors. The night bus had already gone, and he half wished, given what was coming the following day, that he was still on board. Harry spent most of the next day dreading the evening. His morning potions lesson did nothing to dispel his trepidation, as Snape was as unpleasant as ever, and Harry's mood was further lowered by the fact that members of the DA were continually approaching him in the corridors between classes, asking hopefully whether there would be a meeting that night.
"I'll let you know when the next one is," Harry said over and over again. "But I can't do it tonight. I've got to go to, remedial potions." "You take remedial potions?" asked Zachariah Smith superciliously, having cornered Harry in the entrance hall after lunch. "Good Lord, you must be terrible. Snape doesn't usually give extra lessons, does he?"
As Smith strode away in an annoyingly buoyant fashion, Ron glared after him.
"Shall I jinx him? I can still get him from here," he said, raising his wand and taking aim between Smith's shoulder blades.
"Forget it," said Harry dismally.
"It's what everyone's going to think, isn't it? That I'm really stoop."
"Hi, Harry," said a voice behind him. He turned around and found Cho standing there.
"Oh," said Harry as his stomach leapt uncomfortably.
"Hi."
"We'll be in the library, Harry," said Hermione firmly, and she seized Ron above the elbow and dragged him off toward the marble staircase.
"Had a good Christmas?" asked Cho.
"Yeah, not bad," said Harry.
"Mine was pretty quiet," said Cho. For some reason she was looking rather embarrassed. "There's another Hogsmeade trip next month. Did you see the notice?"
"What? Oh, no. I haven't checked the notice board since I got back."
"Yes, it's on Valentine's Day."
"Right," said Harry, wondering why she was telling him this. "Well, I suppose you want to..."
"Only if you do," she said eagerly.
Harry stared. He had been about to say, "I suppose you want to know when the next DA meeting is," but her response did not seem to fit.
He said.
"Oh, it's okay if you don't," she said, looking mortified.
"Don't worry. I'll see you around."
She walked away. Harry stood staring after her, his brain working frantically. Then something clunked into place.
"Cho! Hey, Cho!"
He ran after her, catching her halfway up the marble staircase.
Do you want to come into Hogsmeade with me on Valentine's Day?"
"Oh, yes,"
she said, blushing crimson and beaming at him.
"Right. Well, that's settled then," said Harry.
And, feeling that the day was not going to be a complete loss after all, he headed off to the library to pick up Ron and Hermione before their afternoon lessons, walking in a rather bouncy way himself. By 6 o'clock that evening, however, even the glow of having successfully asked out Cho Chang was insufficient to lighten the ominous feelings that intensified with every step Harry took towards Snape's office. He paused outside the door when he reached it, wishing he were almost anywhere else, then, taking a deep breath, knocked and entered. It was a shadowy room lined with shelves bearing hundreds of glass jars in which floated slimy bits of animals and plants suspended in variously coloured potions. In a corner stood the cupboard full of ingredients that Snape had once accused Harry, not without reason, of robbing. Harry's attention was drawn toward the desk, however, where a shallow stone basin engraved with runes and symbols lay in a pool of candlelight. Harry recognized it at once. Dumbledore's pensive. Wondering what on earth it was doing here, he jumped when Snape's cold voice came out of the corner.
"Shut the door behind you, Potter."
Harry did as he was told, with the horrible feeling that he was imprisoning himself as he did so. When he turned back to face the room, Snape had moved into the light and was pointing silently at the chair opposite his desk. Harry sat down, and so did Snape, his cold black eyes fixed unblinkingly upon Harry, dislike etched in every line of his face.
"Well, Potter, you know why you are here," he said. The headmaster has asked me to teach you occlumency. I can only hope that you prove more adept at it than potions.
Right, said Harry tersely.
This may not be an ordinary class, Potter, said Snape, his eyes narrowed malevolently, but I am still your teacher, and you will therefore call me Sir or Professor at all times.
Yes, Sir, said Harry.
Snape continued to survey him through narrowed eyes for a moment, then said, Now, occlumency. As I told you back in your dear godfather's kitchen, this branch of magic seals the mind against magical intrusion and influence.
And why does Professor Dumbledore think I need it, sir? Said Harry, looking directly into Snape's dark, cold eyes and wondering whether he would answer.
Snape looked back at him for a moment and then said contemptuously, Surely even you could have worked that out by now, Potter. The Dark Lord is highly skilled at legilimency.
What's that, sir?
It is the ability to extract feelings and memories from another person's mind.
He can read minds, said Harry quickly, his worst fears confirmed.
You have no subtlety, Potter, said Snape, his dark eyes glittering. You do not understand fine distinctions. It is one of the shortcomings that makes you such a lamentable potion maker.
Snape paused for a moment, apparently to savor the pleasure of insulting Harry, before continuing,
Only muggles talk of mind-reading. The mind is not a book, to be opened at will and examined at leisure. Thoughts are not etched on the inside of skulls to be perused by any invader. The mind is a complex and many-layered thing, Potter. Or at least most minds are.
He smirked.
It is true, however, that those who have mastered legilimency are able, under certain conditions, to delve into the minds of their victims and to interpret their findings correctly. The Dark Lord, for instance, almost always knows when somebody is lying to him. Only those skilled at occlumency are able to shut down those feelings and memories that contradict the lie and so utter falsehoods in his presence without detection.
Whatever Snape said, legilimency sounded like mind-reading to Harry, and he did not like the sound of it at all.
So he could know what we're thinking right now, sir? The Dark Lord is at a considerable distance, and the walls and grounds of Hogwarts are guarded by many ancient spells and charms to ensure the bodily and mental safety of those who dwell within them, said Snape. Time and space matter in magic, Potter. Eye contact is often essential to legilimency.
Well then, why do I have to learn occlumency?
Snape eyed Harry, tracing his mouth with one long thin finger as he did so. The usual rules do not seem to apply with you, Potter. The curse that failed to kill you seems to have forged some kind of connection between you and the Dark Lord. The evidence suggests that at times when your mind is most relaxed and vulnerable, when you are asleep, for instance, you are sharing the Dark Lord's thoughts and emotions. The headmaster thinks it inadvisable for this to continue. He wishes me to teach you how to close your mind to the Dark Lord.
Harry's heart was pumping fast again. None of this added up.
But why does Professor Dumbledore want to stop it?
He asked abruptly.
I don't like it much, but it's been useful, hasn't it?
I mean, I saw that snake attack Mr. Weasley, and if I hadn't, Professor Dumbledore wouldn't have been able to save him, would he?
Sir.
Snape stared at Harry for a few moments, still tracing his mouth with his finger. When he spoke again, it was slowly and deliberately, as though he weighed every word.
It appears that the Dark Lord has been unaware of the connection between you and himself until very recently. Up till now, it seems that you have been experiencing his emotions and sharing his thoughts without his being any the wiser. However, the vision you had shortly before Christmas,
the one with the snake and Mr. Weasley,
Do not interrupt me, Potter, said Snape in a dangerous voice. As I was saying, the vision you had shortly before Christmas represented such a powerful incursion upon the Dark Lord's thoughts.
I saw inside the snake's head, not his.
I thought I just told you not to interrupt me, Potter.
But Harry did not care if Snape was angry. At last he seemed to be getting to the bottom of this business. He had moved forward in his chair so that, without realizing it, he was perched on the very edge, tense as though poised for flight. "How come I saw through the snake's eyes if it's Voldemort's thoughts I'm sharing?"
"Do not say the Dark Lord's name,"
spat Snape. There was a nasty silence. They glared at each other across the pensive.
"Professor Dumbledore says his name," said Harry quietly.
"Dumbledore is an extremely powerful wizard," Snape muttered. "While he may feel secure enough to use the name, the rest of us..."
He rubbed his left forearm, apparently unconsciously, on the spot where Harry knew the dark mark was burned into his skin.
"I just wanted to know," Harry began again, forcing his voice back to politeness. "Why, you seem to have visited the snake's mind because that was where the Dark Lord was at that particular moment," snarled Snape. "He was possessing the snake at the time, and so you dreamed you were inside it too."
"And Vol, he realized I was there?"
"It seems so," said Snape coolly.
"How do you know?" said Harry urgently. "Is this just Professor Dumbledore guessing, or..."
"I told you,"
said Snape, rigid in his chair, his eyes slits,
"to call me sir."
"Yes, sir," said Harry impatiently. "But how do you know?"
"It is enough that we know," said Snape repressively. "The important point is that the Dark Lord is now aware that you are gaining access to his thoughts and feelings. He has also deduced that the process is likely to work in reverse. That is to say, he has realized that he might be able to access your thoughts and feelings in return."
"And he might try and make me do things?" asked Harry.
"Sir?"
he added hurriedly.
"He might," said Snape, sounding cold and unconcerned.
"Which brings us back to occlumency." Snape pulled out his wand from an inside pocket of his robes, and Harry tensed in his chair. But Snape merely raised the wand to his temple and placed its tip into the greasy roots of his hair. When he withdrew it, some silvery substance came away, stretching from temple to wand like a thick gossamer strand, which broke as he pulled the wand away from it and fell gracefully into the pensive, where it swirled silvery white, neither gas nor liquid. Twice more Snape raised the wand to his temple and deposited the silvery substance into the stone basin. Then, without offering any explanation of his behavior, he picked up the pensive carefully, removed it to a shelf out of their way, and returned to face Harry with his wand held at the ready.
"Stand up and take out your wand, Potter."
Harry got to his feet, feeling nervous. They faced each other with the desk between them.
"You may use your wand to attempt to disarm me, or defend yourself in any other way you can think of," said Snape.
"And what are you going to do?" Harry asked, eyeing Snape's wand apprehensively.
"I am about to attempt to break into your mind," said Snape softly. "We are going to see how well you resist. I have been told that you have already shown aptitude at resisting the Imperius curse. You will find that similar powers are needed for this. Brace yourself now." "Legilimens!"
Snape had struck before Harry was ready, before Harry had even begun to summon any force of resistance. The office swam in front of his eyes and vanished. Image after image was racing through his mind like a flickering film, so vivid it blinded him to his surroundings. He was 5, watching Dudley riding a new red bicycle, and his heart was bursting with jealousy. He was 9, and Ripper the Bulldog was chasing him up a tree, and the Dursleys were laughing below on the lawn. He was sitting under the Sorting Hat, and it was telling him he would do well in Slytherin. Hermione was lying in the hospital wing, her face covered with thick black hair. 100 Dementors were closing in on him beside the Dark Lake. Cho Chang was drawing nearer to him under the mistletoe.
"No,"
said a voice in Harry's head as the memory of Cho drew nearer.
"You're not watching that. You're not watching it. It's private."
He felt a sharp pain in his knee. Snape's office had come back into view, and he realized that he had fallen to the floor. One of his knees had collided painfully with the leg of Snape's desk. He looked up at Snape, who had lowered his wand and was rubbing his wrist. There was an angry wheel there, like a scorch mark.
"Did you mean to produce a stinging hex?"
asked Snape coolly.
No, said Harry bitterly, getting up from the floor.
I thought not, said Snape, watching him closely. You let me get in too far. You lost control.
Did you see everything I saw? Harry asked, unsure whether he wanted to hear the answer.
Flashes of it, said Snape, his lip curling. To whom did the dog belong?
My Aunt Marge, Harry muttered, hating Snape.
Well, for a first attempt, that was not as poor as it might have been, said Snape, raising his wand once more. You managed to stop me eventually, though you wasted time and energy shouting. You must remain focused. Repel me with your brain, and you will not need to resort to your wand.
I'm trying, said Harry angrily, but you're not telling me how.
Manners, Potter, said Snape dangerously. Now, I want you to close your eyes.
Harry threw him a filthy look before doing as he was told. He did not like the idea of standing there with his eyes shut while Snape faced him, carrying a wand.
Clear your mind, Potter, said Snape's cold voice. Let go of all emotion.
But Harry's anger at Snape continued to pound through his veins like venom.
Let go of his anger? He could as easily detach his legs. You're not doing it, Potter. You will need more discipline than this. Focus, now!
Harry tried to empty his mind, tried not to think or remember or feel.
Let's go again. On the count of three. One, two, three. Petulimens.
A great black dragon was rearing in front of him. His father and mother were waving at him out of an enchanted mirror. Cedric Diggory was lying on the ground with blank eyes staring at him.
No!
He was on his knees again, his face buried in his hands, his brain aching as though someone had been trying to pull it from his skull.
Get up, said Snape sharply. Get up! You're not trying, you are making no effort. You are allowing me access to memories you fear, handing me weapons.
Harry stood up again, his heart thumping wildly as though he had really just seen Cedric dead in the graveyard. Snape looked paler than usual, and angrier, though not nearly as angry as Harry was.
I am making an effort, he said through clenched teeth. I told you to empty yourself of emotion.
Yeah? Well, I'm finding that hard at the moment, Harry snarled.
Then you will find yourself easy prey for the Dark Lord, said Snape savagely. Fools who wear their hearts proudly on their sleeves, who cannot control their emotions, who wallow in sad memories and allow themselves to be provoked this easily. Weak people, in other words, they stand no chance against his powers. He will penetrate your mind with absurd ease, Potter.
I am not weak, said Harry in a low voice, fury now pumping through him so that he thought he might attack Snape in a moment.
Then prove it. Master yourself, spat Snape. Control your anger, discipline your mind. We shall try again. Get ready now. Legilimens!
He was watching Uncle Vernon hammering the letterbox shut. 100 Dementors were drifting across the lake in the grounds toward him. He was running along a windowless passage with Mr. Weasley. They were drawing nearer to the plain black door at the end of the corridor. Harry expected to go through it, but Mr. Weasley led him off to the left, down a flight of stone steps.
I know! I know!
He was on all fours again on Snape's office floor. His scar was prickling unpleasantly, but the voice that had just issued from his mouth was triumphant. He pushed himself up again to find Snape staring at him, his wand raised. It looked as though this time Snape had lifted the spell before Harry had even tried to fight back.
What happened then, Potter?
He asked, eyeing Harry intently.
I remembered, Harry panted. I've just realized.
Realized what? Asked Snape sharply.
Harry did not answer at once. He was still savoring the moment of blinding realization as he rubbed his forehead. He had been dreaming about a windowless corridor ending in a locked door for months, without once realizing that it was a real place. Now, seeing the memory again, he knew that all along he had been dreaming about the corridor down which he had run with Mr. Weasley on the 12th of August, as they hurried to the courtrooms in the ministry. It was the corridor leading to the Department of Mysteries, and Mr. Weasley had been there the night that he had been attacked by Voldemort's snake. He looked up at Snape.
What's in the Department of Mysteries?
What did you say?
Snape asked quietly, and Harry saw with deep satisfaction that Snape was unnerved. I said, what's in the Department of Mysteries, sir? Harry said.
And why, said Snape slowly, would you ask such a thing?
Because, said Harry, watching Snape's face closely, that corridor I've just seen, I've been dreaming about it for months, I've just recognized it. It leads to the Department of Mysteries, and I think Voldemort wants something from...
I have told you not to say the Dark Lord's name.
They glared at each other, Harry's scar seared again, but he did not care. Snape looked agitated. When he spoke again, he sounded as though he was trying to appear cool and unconcerned.
There are many things in the Department of Mysteries, Potter, few of which you would understand and none of which concern you. Do I make myself plain?
Yes, Harry said, still rubbing his prickling scar, which was becoming more painful.
I want you back here same time on Wednesday, and we will continue work then.
Fine, said Harry. He was desperate to get out of Snape's office and find Ron and Hermione.
You are to rid your mind of all emotion every night before sleep. Empty it. Make it blank and calm. You understand?
Yes, said Harry, who was barely listening.
And be warned, Potter. I shall know if you have not practiced.
Right, Harry mumbled. He picked up his school bag, swung it over his shoulder, and hurried toward the office door. As he opened it, he glanced back at Snape, who had his back to Harry and was scooping his own thoughts out of the pensive with the tip of his wand and replacing them carefully inside his own head. Harry left without another word, closing the door carefully behind him, his scar still throbbing painfully. Harry found Ron and Hermione in the library, where they were working on Umbridge's most recent ream of homework. Other students, nearly all of them fifth years, sat at lamp-lit tables nearby, noses close to books, quills scratching feverishly, while the sky outside the mullioned windows grew steadily blacker. The only other sound was the slight squeaking of one of Madame Pince's shoes as the librarian prowled the aisles menacingly, breathing down the necks of those touching her precious books. Harry felt shivery. His scar was still aching. He felt almost feverish. When he sat down opposite Ron and Hermione, he caught sight of himself in the window opposite. He was very white, and his scar seemed to be showing up more clearly than usual.
How did it go?
Hermione whispered, and then, looking concerned,
Are you all right, Harry?
Yeah, fine. I don't know, said Harry impatiently, wincing as pain shot through his scar again.
Listen, I've just realized something.
And he told them what he had just seen and deduced.
So are you saying,
whispered Ron, as Madame Pince swept past, squeaking slightly,
that the weapon, the thing you know who's after, is in the Ministry of Magic?
In the Department of Mysteries, it's got to be, Harry whispered. I saw that door when your dad took me down to the courtrooms for my hearing, and it's definitely the same one he was guarding when the snake bit him.
Hermione let out a long, slow sigh.
Of course,
she breathed.
Of course what?
Said Ron rather impatiently.
Ron, think about it. Sturgis Podmore was trying to get through a door at the Ministry of Magic. It must have been that one. It's too much of a coincidence.
How come Sturgis was trying to break in when he's on our side? Said Ron.
Well, I don't know,
Hermione admitted.
That is a bit odd.
So, what's in the Department of Mysteries? Harry asked Ron. Has your dad ever mentioned anything about it?
I know they call the people who work in there unspeakables, said Ron, frowning, because no one really seems to know what they do in there. Weird place to have a weapon. It's not weird at all. It makes perfect sense, said Hermione. It will be something top secret that the Ministry has been developing, I expect. Harry, are you sure you're all right?
For Harry had just run both his hands hard over his forehead, as though trying to iron it.
Yeah, fine,
he said, lowering his hands, which were trembling.
I just feel a bit... I don't like occlumency much. I expect anyone would feel shaky if they'd had their mind attacked over and over again,
said Hermione sympathetically.
Look, let's get back to the common room. We'll be a bit more comfortable there.
But the common room was packed and full of shrieks of laughter and excitement. Fred and George were demonstrating their latest bit of joke shop merchandise.
"Headless hats!" shouted George as Fred waved a pointed hat decorated with a fluffy pink feather at the watching students. "Two galleons each. Watch Fred now."
Fred swept the hat onto his head, beaming. For a second, he merely looked rather stupid. Then both hat and head vanished. Several girls screamed, but everyone else was roaring with laughter.
"And off again," shouted George, and Fred's hand groped for a moment in what seemed to be thin air over his shoulder.
Then his head reappeared as he swept the pink feathered hat from it again.
"How do those hats work, then?"
said Hermione, distracted from her homework and watching Fred and George closely.
"I mean, obviously it's some kind of invisibility spell, but it's rather clever to have extended the field of invisibility beyond the boundaries of the charmed object. I'd imagine the charm wouldn't have a very long life, though."
Harry did not answer. He was still feeling ill. "I'm going to have to do this tomorrow," he muttered, pushing the books he had just taken out of his bag back inside it.
"Well, write it in your homework planner, then," said Hermione encouragingly, "so you don't forget."
Harry and Ron exchanged looks as he reached into his bag, withdrew the planner, and opened it tentatively.
"Don't leave it till later, you big second-rater," chided the book as Harry scribbled down Umbridge's homework.
Hermione beamed at it.
"I think I'll go to bed," said Harry, stuffing the homework planner back into his bag
and making a mental note to drop it in the fire the first opportunity he got. He walked across the common room, dodging George, who tried to put a headless hat on him, and reached the peace and cool of the stone staircase to the boys' dormitories. He was feeling sick again, just as he had the night he had had the vision of the snake, but thought that if he could just lie down for a while, he would be all right. He opened the door of his dormitory and was one step inside it when he experienced pain so severe he thought that someone must have sliced into the top of his head. He did not know where he was, whether he was standing or lying down. He did not even know his own name. Maniacal laughter was ringing in his ears. He was happier than he had been in a very long time. Jubilant, ecstatic, triumphant. A wonderful, wonderful thing had happened.
"Harry? Harry!"
Someone had hit him around the face. The insane laughter was punctuated with a cry of pain. The happiness was draining out of him, but the laughter continued. He opened his eyes, and as he did so, he became aware that the wild laughter was coming out of his own mouth. The moment he realized this, it died away. Harry lay panting on the floor, staring up at the ceiling, the scar on his forehead throbbing horribly. Ron was bending over him, looking very worried.
"What happened?"
he said.
"I don't know,"
Harry gasped, sitting up again.
"He's really happy.
Really happy.
You know who is?"
"Something good's happened," mumbled Harry. He was shaking as badly as he had done after seeing the snake attack Mr. Weasley and felt very sick.
"Something he's been hoping for."
The words came just as they had back in the Gryffindor changing room, as though a stranger was speaking them through Harry's mouth, yet he knew they were true. He took deep breaths, willing himself not to vomit all over Ron. He was very glad that Dean and Seamus were not here to watch this time.
"Hermione told me to come and check on you,"
said Ron in a low voice, helping Harry to his feet.
"She says your defenses will be low at the moment, after Snape's been fiddling around with your mind. Still, I suppose it'll help in the long run, won't it?"
He looked doubtfully at Harry as he helped him toward bed. Harry nodded without any conviction and slumped back on his pillows, aching all over from having fallen to the floor so often that evening, his scar still prickling painfully. He could not help feeling that his first foray into occlumency had weakened his mind's resistance rather than strengthening it, and he wondered with a feeling of great trepidation what had happened to make Lord Voldemort the happiest he had been in 14 years. Chapter 25. The Beetle at Bay. Harry's question was answered the very next morning. When Hermione's Daily Prophet arrived, she smoothed it out, gazed for a moment at the front page, and then gave a yelp that caused everyone in the vicinity to stare at her.
"What?"
said Harry and Ron together.
For an answer, she spread the newspaper on the table in front of them and pointed at 10 black-and-white photographs that filled the whole of the front page. 9 showing wizards' faces, and the 10th a witch's. Some of the people in the photographs were silently jeering. Others were tapping their fingers on the frame of their pictures, looking insolent. Each picture was captioned with a name and the crime for which the person had been sent to Azkaban. Antonin Dolohov, read the legend beneath a wizard with a long, pale, twisted face who was sneering up at Harry, convicted of the brutal murders of Gideon and Fabian Pruitt. Augustus Rookwood, said the caption beneath a pockmarked man with greasy hair who was leaning against the edge of his picture, looking bored. Convicted of leaking Ministry of Magic secrets to He Who Must Not Be Named. But Harry's eyes were drawn to the picture of the witch. Her face had leapt out at him the moment he had seen the page. She had long dark hair that looked unkempt and straggly in the picture, though he had seen it sleek, thick, and shining. She glared up at him through heavily lidded eyes, an arrogant, disdainful smile playing around her thin mouth. Like Sirius, she retained vestiges of great good looks, but something, perhaps Azkaban, had taken most of her beauty. Bellatrix Lestrange, convicted of the torture and permanent incapacitation of Frank and Alice Longbottom. Hermione nudged Harry and pointed at the headline over the pictures, which Harry, concentrating on Bellatrix, had not yet read. Mass breakout from Azkaban. Ministry fears black is rallying point for old Death Eaters.
Black? Said Harry loudly.
Not...
Shh! Whispered Hermione desperately. Not so loud. Just read it.
The Ministry of Magic announced late last night that there has been a mass breakout from Azkaban. Speaking to reporters in his private office, Cornelius Fudge, Minister of Magic, confirmed that 10 high-security prisoners escaped in the early hours of yesterday evening, and that he has already informed the Muggle Prime Minister of the dangerous nature of these individuals. We find ourselves, most unfortunately, in the same position we were 2.5 years ago when the murderous Sirius Black escaped, said Fudge last night. Nor do we think the two breakouts are unrelated. An escape of this magnitude suggests outside help, and we must remember that Black, as the first person ever to break out of Azkaban, would be ideally placed to help others follow in his footsteps. We think it likely that these individuals, who include Black's cousin, Bellatrix Lestrange, have rallied around Black as their leader. We are, however, doing all we can to round up the criminals and beg the magical community to remain alert and cautious. On no account should any of these individuals be approached.
There you are, Harry, said Ron, looking awestruck. That's why he was happy last night.
I don't believe this, snarled Harry.
Fudge is blaming the breakout on Sirius? What other options does he have? Said Hermione bitterly. He can hardly say, sorry, everyone, Dumbledore warned me this might happen. The Azkaban guards have joined Lord Voldemort. Stop whimpering, Ron. And now Voldemort's worst supporters have broken out, too. I mean, he's spent a good 6 months telling everyone you and Dumbledore are liars, hasn't he?
Hermione ripped open the newspaper and began to read the report inside while Harry looked around the Great Hall. He could not understand why his fellow students were not looking scared, or at least discussing the terrible piece of news on the front page, but very few of them took the newspaper every day like Hermione. There they all were, talking about homework and Quidditch, and who knew what other rubbish, and outside these walls 10 more Death Eaters had swollen Voldemort's ranks. He glanced up at the staff table. It was a different story here. Dumbledore and Professor McGonagall were deep in conversation, both looking extremely grave. Professor Sprout had the Prophet propped against a bottle of ketchup and was reading the front page with such concentration that she was not noticing the gentle drip of egg yolk falling into her lap from her stationary spoon. Meanwhile, at the far end of the table, Professor Umbridge was tucking into a bowl of porridge. For once, her pouchy toad's eyes were not sweeping the great hall looking for misbehaving students. She scowled as she gulped down her food, and every now and then she shot a malevolent glance up the table to where Dumbledore and McGonagall were talking so intently.
"Oh, my," said Hermione wonderingly, still staring at the newspaper. "What now?" said Harry quickly. He was feeling jumpy. "It's
Horrible, said Hermione, looking shaken. She folded back page 10 of the newspaper and handed it back to Harry and Ron. Tragic demise of Ministry of Magic worker. St. Mungo's Hospital promised a full inquiry last night after Ministry of Magic worker Broderick Bode, 49, was discovered dead in his bed, strangled by a potted plant. Healers called to the scene were unable to revive Mr. Bode, who had been injured in a workplace accident some weeks prior to his death. Healer Miriam Strout, who was in charge of Mr. Bode's ward at the time of the incident, has been suspended on full pay and was unavailable for comment yesterday. But a spokeswizard for the hospital said in a statement, St. Mungo's deeply regrets the death of Mr. Bode, whose health was improving steadily prior to this tragic accident. We have strict guidelines on the decorations permitted on our wards, but it appears that Healer Strout, busy over the Christmas period, overlooked the dangers of the plant on Mr. Bode's bedside table. As his speech and mobility improved, Healer Strout encouraged Mr. Bode to look after the plant himself, unaware that it was not an innocent flitter bloom, but a cutting of devil's snare, which, when touched by the convalescent Mr. Bode, throttled him instantly. St. Mungo's is as yet unable to account for the presence of the plant on the ward and asks any witch or wizard with information to come forward.
Bode, said Ron. Bode! It rings a bell.
We saw him, Hermione whispered, in St. Mungo's, remember? He was in the bed opposite Lockhart's, just lying there, staring at the ceiling. And we saw the devil's snare arrive. She, the healer, said it was a Christmas present.
Harry looked back at the story. A feeling of horror was rising like bile in his throat.
How come we didn't recognize Devil's Snare? We've seen it before. We could have stopped this from happening. Who expects Devil's Snare to turn up in a hospital disguised as a potted plant? Said Ron sharply. It's not our fault. Whoever sent it to the bloke is to blame. They must be a real prat. Why didn't they check what they were buying?
Oh, come on, Ron, said Hermione shakily. I don't think anyone could put Devil's Snare in a pot and not realize it tries to kill whoever touches it. This was murder. A clever murder as well. If the plant was sent anonymously, how's anyone ever going to find out who did it?
Harry was not thinking about Devil's Snare. He was remembering taking the lift down to the 9th level of the ministry on the day of his hearing and the sallow-faced man who had got in on the atrium level.
I met Bode, he said slowly. I saw him at the ministry with your dad.
Ron's mouth fell open.
I've heard Dad talk about him at home. He was an unspeakable. He worked in the Department of Mysteries.
They looked at one another for a moment. Then Hermione pulled the newspaper back toward her, closed it, glared for a moment at the pictures of the 10 escaped Death Eaters on the front, then leapt to her feet.
Where are you going? Said Ron, startled. To send a letter, said Hermione, swinging her bag onto her shoulder. I don't know whether, but it's worth trying, and I'm the only one who can.
I hate it when she does that,
grumbled Ron, as he and Harry got up from the table and made their own slower way out of the great hall.
Would it kill her to tell us what she's up to for once? It'd take her about 10 more seconds. Hey, Hagrid!
Hagrid was standing beside the doors into the entrance hall, waiting for a crowd of Ravenclaws to pass. He was still as heavily bruised as he had been on the day he had come back from his mission to the Giants, and there was a new cut right across the bridge of his nose.
All right, you two,
he said, trying to muster a smile, but managing only a kind of pained grimace.
Are you okay, Hagrid?
Asked Harry, following him as he lumbered after the Ravenclaws.
Fine, fine,
said Hagrid, with a feeble assumption of airiness. He waved a hand and narrowly missed concussing a frightened-looking Professor Vector who was passing.
Just busy, you know, usual stuff. Lessons to prepare. Couple of salamanders got scale rot, and I'm on probation, he mumbled.
You're on probation?
Said Ron very loudly, so that many students passing looked around curiously.
Sorry, I mean, you're on probation?
He whispered.
Yeah,
said Hagrid.
It's no more than I expected, to tell you the truth. You might not have picked up on it, but that inspection didn't go too well. You know, anyway,
he sighed deeply.
Best go and rub a bit more chili powder on them salamanders, or their tails will be hanging off 'em next. See you, Harry, Ron.
He trudged away, out the front doors and down the stone steps into the damp grounds. Harry watched him go, wondering how much more bad news he could stand. The fact that Hagrid was now on probation became common knowledge within the school over the next few days, but to Harry's indignation, hardly anybody appeared to be upset about it. Indeed, some people, Draco Malfoy prominent among them, seemed positively gleeful. As for the freakish death of an obscure Department of Mysteries employee in St. Mungo's, Harry, Ron and Hermione seemed to be the only people who knew or cared. There was only one topic of conversation in the corridors now, the 10 escaped Death Eaters, whose story had finally filtered through the school from those few people who read the newspapers. Rumors were flying that some of the convicts had been spotted in Hogsmeade, that they were supposed to be hiding out in the Shrieking Shack, and that they were going to break into Hogwarts, just as Sirius Black had done. Those who came from wizarding families had grown up hearing the names of these Death Eaters spoken with almost as much fear as Voldemort's. The crimes they had committed during the days of Voldemort's reign of terror were legendary. There were relatives of their victims among the Hogwarts students, who now found themselves the unwilling objects of a gruesome sort of reflected fame as they walked the corridors. Susan Bones, who had an uncle, an aunt, and cousins who had all died at the hands of one of the 10, said, miserably during herbology, that she now had a good idea what it felt like to be Harry.
"And I don't know how you stand it. It's horrible," she said bluntly, dumping far too much dragon manure on her tray of screech-snap seedlings, causing them to wiggle and squeak in discomfort.
It was true that Harry was the subject of much renewed muttering and pointing in the corridors these days, yet he thought he detected a slight difference in the tone of the whisperers' voices. They sounded curious rather than hostile now, and once or twice he was sure he overheard snatches of conversation that suggested that the speakers were not satisfied with the prophet's version of how and why 10 Death Eaters had managed to break out of Azkaban Fortress. In their confusion and fear, these doubters now seemed to be turning to the only other explanation available to them, the one that Harry and Dumbledore had been expounding since the previous year. It was not only the students' mood that had changed. It was now quite common to come across two or three teachers conversing in low, urgent whispers in the corridors, breaking off their conversations the moment they saw students approaching.
"They obviously can't talk freely in the staff room anymore," said Hermione in a low voice, as she, Harry and Ron passed Professors McGonagall, Flitwick and Sprout huddled together outside the Charms classroom one day. "Not with Umbridge there." "Reckon they know anything new?" said Ron, gazing back over his shoulder at the three teachers.
"If they do, we're not going to hear about it, are we?" said Harry angrily.
"Not after decree... What number are we on now?"
For new signs had appeared on the house notice boards the morning after news of the Azkaban breakout. "By order of the High Inquisitor of Hogwarts, teachers are hereby banned from giving students any information that is not strictly related to the subjects they are paid to teach. The above is in accordance with Educational Decree No. 26, signed Dolores Jane Umbridge, High Inquisitor." This latest decree had been the subject of a great number of jokes among the students. Lee Jordan had pointed out to Umbridge that by the terms of the new rule, she was not allowed to tell Fred and George off for playing Exploding Snap in the back of the class.
"Exploding Snap's got nothing to do with defense against the dark arts, Professor. That's not information relating to your subject."
When Harry next saw Lee, the back of his hand was bleeding rather badly. Harry recommended essence of Mertlap. Harry had thought that the breakout from Azkaban might have humbled Umbridge a little, that she might have been abashed at the catastrophe that had occurred right under her beloved Fudge's nose. It seemed, however, to have only intensified her furious desire to bring every aspect of life at Hogwarts under her personal control. She seemed determined, at the very least, to achieve a sacking before long. And the only question was whether it would be Professor Trelawney or Hagrid who went first. Every single divination and care of magical creatures lesson was now conducted in the presence of Umbridge and her clipboard. She lurked by the fire in the heavily perfumed tower room, interrupting Professor Trelawney's increasingly hysterical talks with difficult questions about ornithomancy and heptamology, insisting that she predict students' answers before they gave them, and demanding that she demonstrate her skill at the crystal ball, the tea leaves, and the rune stones in turn.
Harry thought that Professor Trelawney might soon crack under the strain. Several times he passed her in the corridors, in itself a very unusual occurrence, as she generally remained in her tower room, muttering wildly to herself, wringing her hands and shooting terrified glances over her shoulder, all the time giving off a powerful smell of cooking sherry. If he had not been so worried about Hagrid, he would have felt sorry for her. But if one of them was to be ousted out of a job, there could be only one choice for Harry as to who should remain. Unfortunately, Harry could not see that Hagrid was putting up a better show than Trelawney. Though he seemed to be following Hermione's advice and had shown them nothing more frightening than a Krupp, a creature indistinguishable from a Jack Russell Terrier, except for its forked tail, since before Christmas, he also seemed to have lost his nerve. He was oddly distracted and jumpy in lessons, losing the thread of what he was saying while talking to the class, answering questions wrongly and glancing anxiously at Umbridge all the time. He was also more distant with Harry, Ron and Hermione than he had ever been before, expressly forbidding them to visit him after dark.
"If she catches you, it'll be all of our necks on the line,"
he told them flatly. And with no desire to do anything that jeopardized his job further, they abstained from walking down to his hut in the evenings. It seemed to Harry that Umbridge was steadily depriving him of everything that made his life at Hogwarts worth living. Visits to Hagrid's house, letters from Sirius, his firebolt, and Quidditch. He took his revenge the only way he had, redoubling his efforts for the DA. Harry was pleased to see that all of them, even Zacharias Smith, had been spurred to work harder than ever by the news that 10 more Death Eaters were now on the loose. But in nobody was this improvement more pronounced than in Neville. The news of his parents' attacker's escape had wrought a strange and even slightly alarming change in him. He had not once mentioned his meeting with Harry, Ron and Hermione on the closed ward in St. Mungo's, and, taking their lead from him, they had kept quiet about it too. Nor had he said anything on the subject of Bellatrix and her fellow torturer's escape. In fact, he barely spoke during DA meetings anymore, but worked relentlessly on every new jinx and counter-curse Harry taught them, his plump face screwed up in concentration, apparently indifferent to injuries or accidents, working harder than anyone else in the room. He was improving so fast it was quite unnerving, and when Harry taught them the shield charm, a means of deflecting minor jinxes so that they rebounded upon the attacker, only Hermione mastered the charm faster than Neville. In fact, Harry would have given a great deal to be making as much progress at Occlumency as Neville was making during DA meetings. Harry's sessions with Snape, which had started badly enough, were not improving. On the contrary, Harry felt he was getting worse with every lesson. Before he had started studying Occlumency, his scar had prickled occasionally, usually during the night, or else following one of those strange flashes of Voldemort's thoughts or moods that he experienced every now and then. Nowadays, however, his scar hardly ever stopped prickling, and he often felt lurches of annoyance or cheerfulness that were unrelated to what was happening to him at the time, which were always accompanied by a particularly painful twinge from his scar. He had the horrible impression that he was slowly turning into a kind of aerial that was tuned into tiny fluctuations in Voldemort's mood, and he was sure he could date this increased sensitivity firmly from his first occlumency lesson with Snape. What was more, he was now dreaming about walking down the corridor toward the entrance to the Department of Mysteries almost every night, dreams that always culminated in him standing longingly in front of the plain black door.
"Maybe it's a bit like an illness," said Hermione, looking concerned when Harry confided in her and Ron. "A fever or something. It has to get worse before it gets better."
"It's lessons with Snape that are making it worse," said Harry flatly. "I'm getting sick of my scar hurting, and I'm getting bored walking down that corridor every night." He rubbed his forehead angrily. "I just wish the door would open. I'm sick of standing staring at it."
"That's not funny," said Hermione sharply. "Dumbledore doesn't want you to have dreams about that corridor at all, or he wouldn't have asked Snape to teach you occlumency. You're just going to have to work a bit harder in your lessons."
"I am working," said Harry, nettled. "You try it sometime. Snape trying to get inside your head. It's not a bundle of laughs, you know."
"Maybe," said Ron slowly.
"Maybe what?"
said Hermione rather snappishly.
"Maybe it's not Harry's fault he can't close his mind," said Ron darkly.
"What do you mean?"
said Hermione.
"Well, maybe Snape isn't really trying to help Harry."
Harry and Hermione stared at him. Ron looked darkly and meaningfully from one to the other.
Maybe, he said again in a lower voice, he's actually trying to open Harry's mind a bit wider, make it easier for you, no...
Shut up, Ron, said Hermione angrily. How many times have you suspected Snape? And when have you ever been right? Dumbledore trusts him. He works for the Order. That ought to be enough.
He used to be a Death Eater, said Ron stubbornly, and we've never seen proof that he really swaps sides.
Dumbledore trusts him, Hermione repeated, and if we can't trust Dumbledore, we can't trust anyone.
With so much to worry about and so much to do, startling amounts of homework that frequently kept the 5th years working until past midnight, secret DA meetings and regular classes with Snape, January seemed to be passing alarmingly fast. Before Harry knew it, February had arrived, bringing with it wetter and warmer weather and the prospect of the second Hogsmeade visit of the year. Harry had had very little time to spare on conversations with Cho since they had agreed to visit the village together, but suddenly found himself facing a Valentine's Day spent entirely in her company. On the morning of the 14th, he dressed particularly carefully. He and Ron arrived at breakfast just in time for the arrival of the post-owls. Hedwig was not there. Not that he had expected her, but Hermione was tugging a letter from the beak of an unfamiliar brown owl as they sat down.
And about time! If it hadn't come today, she said eagerly, tearing open the envelope and pulling out a small piece of parchment.
Her eyes sped from left to right as she read through the message, and a grimly pleased expression spread across her face.
Listen, Harry, she said, looking up at him. This is really important. Do you think you could meet me in the 3 Broomsticks around midday?
Well, I don't know, said Harry dubiously. Cho might be expecting me to spend the whole day with her. We never said what we were going to do.
Well, bring her along if you must, said Hermione urgently. But will you come?
Well, all right, but why?
I haven't got time to tell you now. I've got to answer this quickly.
And she hurried out of the great hall, the letter clutched in one hand and a piece of uneaten toast in the other.
Are you coming? Harry asked Ron, but he shook his head, looking glum. I can't come into Hogsmeade at all. Angelina wants a full day's training. Like it's going to help. We're the worst team I've ever seen. You should see Sloper and Kirk. They're pathetic, even worse than I am.
He heaved a great sigh.
I don't know why Angelina won't just let me resign.
It's because you're good when you're on form. That's why, said Harry irritably.
He found it very hard to be sympathetic to Ron's plight when he himself would have given almost anything to be playing in the forthcoming match against Hufflepuff. Ron seemed to notice Harry's tone because he did not mention Quidditch again during breakfast, and there was a slight frostiness in the way they said goodbye to each other shortly afterward. Ron departed for the Quidditch pitch, and Harry, after attempting to flatten his hair while staring at his reflection in the back of a teaspoon, proceeded alone to the entrance hall to meet Cho, feeling very apprehensive and wondering what on earth they were going to talk about. She was waiting for him a little to the side of the oak front doors, looking very pretty with her hair tied back in a long ponytail. Harry's feet seemed to be too big for his body as he walked toward her, and he was suddenly horribly aware of his arms and how stupid they looked swinging at his sides.
Hi,
said Cho, slightly breathlessly.
Hi, said Harry.
They stared at each other for a moment, then Harry said,
Well, shall we go then?
Oh, yes.
They joined the queue of people being signed out by Filch, occasionally catching each other's eye and grinning shiftily, but not talking to each other. Harry was relieved when they reached the fresh air, finding it easier to walk along in silence than just stand there looking awkward. It was a fresh, breezy sort of day, and as they passed the Quidditch Stadium, Harry glimpsed Ron and Ginny skimming over the stands and felt a horrible pang that he was not up there with them.
You really miss it, don't you?
Said Cho. He looked around and saw her watching him.
Yeah, sighed Harry. I do.
Remember the first time we played against each other in the 3rd year?
She asked him.
Yeah, said Harry, grinning. You kept blocking me.
And Wood told you not to be a gentleman and knock me off my broom if you had to,
said Cho, smiling reminiscently.
I heard he got taken on by Pride of Portree. Is that right?
Nah, it was Puddlemere United. I saw him at the World Cup last year.
Oh, I saw you there too, remember? We were on the same campsite. It was really good, wasn't it?
The subject of the Quidditch World Cup carried them all the way down the drive and out through the gates. Harry could hardly believe how easy it was to talk to her,
no more difficult, in fact, than talking to Ron and Hermione. And he was just starting to feel confident and cheerful when a large gang of Slytherin girls passed them, including Pansy Parkinson.
"Potter and Chang!"
screeched Pansy to a chorus of snide giggles.
"Ooh, Chang, I don't think much of your taste. At least Degree was good-looking."
They sped up, talking and shrieking in a pointed fashion, with many exaggerated glances back at Harry and Cho, leaving an embarrassed silence in their wake. Harry could think of nothing else to say about Quidditch, and Cho, slightly flushed, was watching her feet.
So, where do you want to go?
Harry asked as they entered Hogsmeade. The high street was full of students ambling up and down, peering into the shop windows and messing about together on the pavements.
"Oh, I don't mind," said Cho, shrugging. "Shall we just have a look in the shops or something?"
They wandered toward Dervish and Bangs. A large poster had been stuck up in the window, and a few Hogsmeaders were looking at it. They moved aside when Harry and Cho approached, and Harry found himself staring once more at the 10 pictures of the escaped Death Eaters. The poster, by order of the Ministry of Magic, offered 1,000 galleon reward to any witch or wizard with information relating to the recapture of any of the convicts pictured.
"It's funny, isn't it?"
said Cho in a low voice, also gazing up at the pictures of the Death Eaters.
"Remember when that Sirius Black escaped, and there were Dementors all over Hogsmeade looking for him? And now 10 Death Eaters are on the loose, and there aren't Dementors anywhere."
"Yeah," said Harry, tearing his eyes away from Bellatrix Lestrange's face to glance up and down the high street.
"Yeah, it is weird."
He was not sorry that there were no Dementors nearby, but now he came to think of it, their absence was highly significant. They had not only let the Death Eaters escape, they were not bothering to look for them. It looked as though they really were outside Ministry control now. The 10 escaped Death Eaters were staring out of every shop window he and Cho passed. It started to rain as they passed Scriven shafts. Cold, heavy drops of water kept hitting Harry's face and the back of his neck.
"Do you want to get a coffee?"
said Cho tentatively as the rain began to fall more heavily.
"Yeah, all right," said Harry, looking around. Oh, there's a really nice place just up here. Haven't you ever been to Madame Puddyfoot's?"
she said brightly, and she led him up a side road and into a small tea shop that Harry had never noticed before. It was a cramped, steamy little place where everything seemed to have been decorated with frills or bows. Harry was reminded unpleasantly of Umbridge's office.
"Cute, isn't it?" said Cho happily.
Yeah," said Harry untruthfully.
"Look, she's decorated it for Valentine's Day,"
said Cho, indicating a number of golden cherubs that were hovering over each of the small circular tables, occasionally throwing pink confetti over the occupants.
"Ah."
They sat down at the last remaining table, which was situated in the steamy window. Roger Davies, the Ravenclaw Quidditch captain, was sitting about 1.5 feet away with a pretty blonde girl. They were holding hands. The sight made Harry feel uncomfortable, particularly when, looking around the tea shop, he saw that it was full of nothing but couples, all of them holding hands. Perhaps Cho would expect him to hold her hand.
"What can I get you, me dears?"
said Madame Puddyfoot, a very stout woman with a shiny black bun, squeezing between their table and Roger Davis's with great difficulty.
"Two coffees, please," said Cho.
In the time it took for their coffees to arrive, Roger Davis and his girlfriend started kissing over their sugar bowl. Harry wished they wouldn't. He felt that Davis was setting a standard with which Cho would soon expect him to compete. He felt his face growing hot and tried staring out of the window, but it was so steamed up he could not see the street outside. To postpone the moment when he had to look at Cho, he stared up at the ceiling as though examining the paintwork and received a handful of confetti in the face from their hovering cherub. After a few more painful minutes, Cho mentioned Umbridge. Harry seized on the subject with relief, and they passed a few happy moments abusing her. But the subject had already been so thoroughly canvassed during DA meetings, it did not last very long. Silence fell again. Harry was very conscious of these slurping noises coming from the table next door, and cast wildly around for something else to say.
Listen, do you want to come with me to the 3 Broomsticks at lunchtime? I'm meeting Hermione Granger there."
Cho raised her eyebrows.
"You're meeting Hermione Granger? Today?"
"Yeah. Well, she asked me to, so I thought I would. Do you want to come with me? She said it wouldn't matter if you did."
Oh, well, that was nice of her.
But Cho did not sound as though she thought it was nice at all. On the contrary, her tone was cold, and all of a sudden she looked rather forbidding. A few more minutes passed in total silence, Harry drinking his coffee so fast that he would soon need a fresh cup. Next door, Roger Davis and his girlfriend seemed glued together by the lip.